So it was madness. Vali had heard rumours, but he had taken them for just that, things said by the men of Rogaland to make them feel more comfortable with their warlike neighbour. You could hear stories like that about any king, should you bother to inquire. Vali thought for a moment, and then said, "So, what is required of me? What would my mother have me do?" "Simply come home to the court. She only had to send for me. This way raises the least suspicion," said Hongni.
"Suspicion of what?"
"Things are underway that I have no right to discuss. It's for the queen to speak to you. We meet a ship half a day west of here, and on that we will bring you home."
Vali nodded. He still wanted the horse, but knew there was no way of getting it other than by deception.
"Good," he said. "I'll be glad to come. Here, let me sit by your fire and share a drink for a while."
He moved to the fire, sat down, and the man offered him the remains of a cooked hare with thick bread. He still had that horrid feeling of sickness in him, but he forced himself to eat and to suppress the thank you that Disa had drummed into him. Gratitude was fine for farmers, not for princes. He would rule these men one day, and he knew very well that kings took such things as a right. They ate, and the men's manners and customs seemed faintly strange to Vali. He had been raised among the Rigir, and to him the way Hongni and Ori spoke was slightly odd. He had known, for instance, that the Horda called a cooking pot a hot cup, but it still felt strange to hear it described that way, as if it could never have been called anything else. When the men had finished their meal, they took a tiny pinch of salt, spat, and threw it to the ground, saying, "For Loki's eyes." The words struck him as strange. Of all the gods, thought Vali, Loki was the most interesting. He was the sly god, the one who fooled the others, and Vali still loved to hear tales of his cunning. It even struck him as funny that he had killed the beautiful god Baldur for no other reason, it seemed to Vali, than that the perfect one had bored him. When Vali had been a young child, Bragi had beaten him when he laughed at how Loki had contrived to make Baldur stay in the underworld after death by refusing to mourn for him.
"You like that naughty fellow so much, perhaps you'd like to share his torments. They lashed him to a rock for his crimes. Shall I so lash you?" he had said.
Disa had taken Vali in and consoled him.
"Not everything funny is to be laughed at," she said. "Well, not out loud, anyway."
He wondered how Disa was. He couldn't believe that he hadn't stayed to help her and hoped she was all right. Had the ritual been worth it? The question seemed to crumble in his mind as he felt the need to look behind him, to the north. That was the direction he had been travelling, and where he instinctively felt that he wanted to go. He had to get there. But first, he needed to concentrate on his deceit, make these men confident of him.
"How did you find me here?" Vali asked Ori.
Ori laughed.
"There is only one road north in the summer, and it's hardly used, as the merchants prefer the sea. In the winter, when the rivers freeze, then there are 100 quick paths this way, and your wolfman would be harder to find. In summer, one road, one opportunity for ambush, few travellers. You'd have more difficulty avoiding them than digging them out."
"If wolfmen are so easy to find, it's a wonder Lord Orthon hasn't done so yet," said Vali.
Hongni waved his hand.
"The king has other concerns," he said.
Vali said nothing more. He knew that the summer would be an easy time to draw down the wolfmen. The reindeer were well-fed and energetic, as were all the animals, and their tracks were not so easy to follow. Hunting without a bow or snares, as the wolfmen were said to do, would be very difficult. It was well known the peril they offered was greatest to summer travellers, and this was one of the reasons they had remained unmolested for so long. kings went by boat in fine weather. Only the poor, the foolish, and outlaws suffered from their attacks. Nausea suddenly took him, as if the toad he had imagined in his throat was alive and kicking to get out. He put down the bone he'd been picking at and tried to stop himself from vomiting. He managed it, just.
"You are pale, Lord. Does our meal disagree with you?"
asked Ori. Vali composed himself.
"We will continue to my homeland now," he said.
"We have not slept, Lord."
"I have," said Vali.
"We will go now." The two men made no complaint, got up and put the tack on the horses. As they did, Vali fought down the rising sickness inside him and kept up a stream of questions about Hordaland. Was it true that his father kept wolves as pets? He knew this to be false. Did traders from the east still come to the Horda? Were the girls of the Horda still pretty?
"The rumour is, Lord, that you only have eyes for that farm girl."
Vali made himself laugh. He had turned the conversation just the way he wanted it.
"She is a useful piece in my strategy with Forkbeard. The weaker he thinks my passion for his daughter, the greater will be her dowry."
"You are a cunning man, sir," said Hongni, laughing. "They say no one in the north is your better at king's table."
"No southern man would beat me either," said Vali, mindful that such men as these respected bravado. "Now bring me my horse."
Hongni gave up his mount for his prince without question. Vali looked across at Ori, who was swinging himself into his saddle. He was a lean man, lightly dressed, no armour, only his spear and helmet. Could he outrun him on a strange and potentially unreliable horse? No. Vali turned to him.
"This animal stinks. Give me yours, Ori."
Ori looked oddly at the prince.
"This one stinks the same, sir."
"I want the horse, not a debate. Get down."
Vali looked into Ori's eyes, and the warrior thought that he glimpsed a little of King Orthon in the prince. Ori dismounted, and as he did so, Vali brought his own animal's hindquarters into the flank of Ori's horse. The beast stepped sideways, knocking Ori to the ground. Vali snatched the reins, put his heels into his own horse's flanks, and shot forward, taking both animals with him. He was clear of the men in an instant, not even bothering to look back as he urged the creatures on. They shouted after him,
"You have sentenced us to death, sir!
We cannot return without you!
The Rigir's fate is sealed!
They are as the dead!"
He didn't turn, just kept driving on up the valley, the feeling of sickness leaving him as he moved. He had, he thought, a good chance of getting away. He had two horses, was well rested, and would be pursued on foot by men needing sleep. He reached the top of the valley, and found himself on a broad ridge above hills that stretched away to distant mountains skirted by trees, a fjord just beneath him. Did he follow the ridge, or drop down to the east? He rode a few steps east, then north. Did he feel any more sick going in one direction than another? He couldn't really tell. He allowed the horses to slow at the top of the hill, and his mind turned back to the house and Maadisa. Ansus was the rune she had carved, the rune in which she had put her faith. Vali visualized the rune in his mind, even moving his hands in the air to mark out its three lines, one vertical, the others on a slant. He tried the rhyme Disa had used.
"Who am I? I am a man. Where am I? In the hills of the north."
He only succeeded in making himself feel ridiculous. But something did happen. His horse stumbled. He looked down at it. The animal was in a great sweat. At first he thought he might be in the presence of some supernatural thing. They were said to frighten animals. But the other horse was not sweating nearly as much. He looked around him, The light was subtly different. The ridge was coming into trees. Then he realized he had travelled a great way. The animal desperately needed rest. He dismounted and led the horses to a stream. There was plenty enough grass for pasture, though he had no food himself. Never mind, he thought. The feeling of nausea was faint, but surprisingly welcome. It was a lucky coincidence to be off your food if you had none. A fire was out of the question with pursuers on his back. So he watered the horses, removed the tack, hobbled them, and waited. He didn't attempt to sleep, nor to take his mind off the cold, and, beneath that, his nausea and hunger. It was as if he was driven by some instinct that told him suffering was something he could offer the gods. He had never seen the point of sacrifice, of stuffing funeral ships with gold or slaughtering animals and slaves. But here, in tiredness and discomfort, he felt connected to something fundamental inside him. His bodily pain was nothing to what he felt for her. He could endure far worse, he knew, and his love would sustain him. The next morning he set off again, picturing that rune in his mind. He saw Disa carving it, first on the wood and then on her hand. He saw the blood drip and fall, and where it fell it ran again into the shape of the rune. Then he was aware of the warmth of the horse under him. By the position of the sun, he had clearly been riding for hours. It was a peculiar feeling, driving forward with great purpose, but not really knowing where he was going. The horses allowed him to travel much more quickly than he would have managed on foot. Vali found himself riding across high passes, dropping down perilous slopes of scree, fording rivers and skirting fjords, but always as a passenger, rather than as someone choosing his way. He seemed to instruct the horses without thinking about it. There were signs he was on the right route, broken and discarded footwear by the side of a trail, the occasional marks of wagon wheels and hooves. He saw next to no one, just far-off shepherds and the occasional homestead. He took care to sound his horn as he passed, to avoid being mistaken for an outlaw, but did not stop. Only the needs of the animals slowed him down, and though sometimes he drank when they drank, he never ate and rarely slept. Thinking about Disa's rune seemed to have wakened something deep inside him, but thirst, hunger, and tiredness combined to dull his conscious mind. It was hardly surprising, then, that he did not hear the approach of the Wolfman. Chapter 14. The Prince and the Wolf. Felek had been watching the rider for days, assessing the man's strength. Lone horsemen in the inland mountains were never seen, and to the large part of Felek's mind that had become wolf, this was suspicious. Also, the traveller was not on the trading route. He was 2 days north of that, in the back country, just above the tree line in a narrow, dark gorge following a tiny stream. All animals are wary of things they haven't seen before, and Felek was no different. But there was something uniquely threatening about the man in the valley. In other circumstances, he would have called across the mountains to Kveldulf, but the shapeshifter had been gone for days, as he sometimes was, leaving Felek to hunt with only three of the pack for company. The wolves and Felek, of course, wanted the horses, and knew that the easiest way to get them was to wait for the man to sleep. Without Felek's help, the wolves would have had to wait for one of the animals to wander off at night, which might not happen. Stories of wolfmen attacking camps of travellers were sometimes true, but it wasn't something they did by choice, and usually only in summer. In the hungry, hot months, when the animals ran swiftly and the berries were not yet on the trees, Kveldulf and Felek had to take their food where they could get it. Native traders wondered why the whale people of the northern edge managed to travel by land without trouble from the wolfmen, and imagined that they had some charm or spell that kept them safe. It was simpler than that. The whale people lived among bears and stored their food well away from their camps, hanging it in packs from the thinnest possible branches of trees. The wolfmen would only fight if travellers caught them stealing their food and animals. The whale people sometimes lost their dinners, but always kept their lives. Feleg waited for the rider to sleep, but the rider did not sleep, or at least Feleg could not be sure he was sleeping. When the pale grey of the long dusk came down, the man just dismounted and saw to the horses, then sat on the ground, clinging to his sword and rocking back and forth. Feleg saw few people with black hair, fewer still who seemed to care for their animals better than they did themselves, and none who never ate. But none of these things accounted for the feeling of disquiet he had when looking down from his hiding place at the figure below him. Feleg had some remaining idea of magic from his time with the berserks, but having spent so long with Kveldulf, he no longer saw it as something separate from any other way of being. It was no more incredible that he could send himself into a trance where he would track, move, and fight as a wolf than it was that a stream fell down a mountainside, or that birth and death came to man and animals. No more incredible than breath, the rising and sinking of the sun and moon, the movement of the tides. To Feleg, creation seemed a rhythm that he connected to in ritual and meditation with rattle and drum. That man, there in the valley, was where the rhythm broke down, he felt. When he looked at him, he shivered. He had the wordless sense that the rider was a stumble in nature's beat. The wolfman scented the wind. Nothing to learn there, just the smell of horses and rain coming from the dark mountain behind him. Then he realized what was strange. He wasn't interested in the rider for his horses or his food. He was curious about him. For some reason, he wanted to see him closer. It was the sort of human feeling he had allowed to atrophy, and its reawakening left him feeling puzzled and a little miserable. He put it to the back of his mind and concentrated on his hunger. Vali's thoughts were elsewhere. He thought of Adisla, imprisoned by Forkbeard. He thought of Disa. Mostly he just thought of that rune. Its image, and even more strangely, its sound, as Vali imagined it, had been humming through his head for days. The rune seemed to bring with it a music that was related to how people said its name, Ansuz, but was more than that. He remembered the voice of the thing that had spoken through Disa, sounding like the drawing and pushing of the surf. That was how the rune sounded. Then, in an instant, all the human feelings he had ignored on his long ride came back. He was terribly hungry and thirsty, and tired as he had never been before. These feelings seemed important to him, to contain a message. No more nausea. He had arrived where he needed to be. He looked around, his eyes heavy and refusing to focus properly, his mind telling him that the most important task he had was sleep. Vali pushed his face into a stream and drank. Then he opened his pack. He took out some hunks of salted bread, along with some pickled fish. He ate the food quickly, drank again, and then settled down. He had not made a proper bed the whole journey. Now he spread a walrus skin on the ground, put his cloak about him, and used the pack as a pillow. His tiredness had not quite taken his reason away, and he was careful to conceal himself with scrub beneath an overhang. But in the dwindling grey light of the midsummer dusk, he could not make his eyes scan for enemies. He was simply too tired, and he sank onto the comfort of his bed. Feilig watched all this from above. Now he felt he could move. When he did, it was with liquid speed, dropping silently down the sides of the gorge to the shadows of the valley floor. He went forward alone, the wolves watching him from the valley lip. Feilig kept to the same side of the gorge on which Vali was sleeping, slinking low but fast towards his target. The horses were past the sleeping man, and Feilig felt there was a chance he could take them without waking him. It was too big a risk, however. Who knew who was riding to meet the sleeper? Who knew if he was an experienced tracker, or even a sorcerer? He would have to die. To Feilig's keen senses, threat oozed from the sleeping man. It hummed like a nest of bees in a cave mouth, seeped into his consciousness like fire on the breeze. There was only one way to make it go away. The quickest way to kill someone in their sleep depends on how they are lying. If he is on his front, then it's relatively easy to break his neck with an arm around the head and a knee in the back. Feilig had done this two or three times, and found that even if the neck didn't break, he still had an effective stranglehold on his prey and could finish him very quickly. If the man was on his side or back, then he might stamp him to death. Other times, when silence was necessary, he had power enough in his fingers to crush his throat. Feilig, perhaps it is better to call him the Wolfman, because the hormonal surge he felt within him at the prospect of killing made his humanity seem a weak and withered thing, didn't make a sound as he reached the brush that concealed the sleeping man. The man was on his back, and the Wolfman decided to creep up on his victim and twist his neck. There was a growl, low and guttural. The Wolfman glanced around to see where it had come from. He hadn't made the noise himself. It was like nothing natural, and he felt a chill creep down his spine. Every pore seemed open and sweating, his body signalling danger with every sense. The growl came again, even lower, like rock on rock. Feilig flattened himself to the ground. A third growl, this time like something coming from the lower earth. And a word. Adisla. Feilig looked up. The noise was coming from the sleeping man. He was snoring. Feilig's mind went back to the hut of the berserks where he had been raised. His memories of that time were now just impressions. The dark of the hut, the smell of his mother's skirts, a glimpse of himself being chased in a game by the girls he considered his sisters. Only one incident stuck out. The man he had called father had snored like thunder, especially when drunk. The children had put feathers on his lips and hooted as he puffed them away. He remembered one of the girls putting one next to her father's behind to see if that moved when he farted. It had moved, and Feilig had thought he would never stop laughing. Looking down at the sleeping valley, he heard another strange noise, like the babble of a stream. It was, he realized, coming from himself. He was chuckling. He hadn't done that in a long time. As he laughed, a glimpse of the meaning of human interaction returned to him, or rather, a fleeting delight in inanities, and he felt a sort of fellowship with the snoring man, almost the desire to wake him and tell him how loud, how funny he sounded. But Feilig had to kill him. The focus, those who didn't know wolfmen called it rage, that made this easier, though, had been carried away by his laughter. He looked hard at Vali. Feilig hadn't seen his own face since he was 6, and then only rarely. His image of himself had been mainly formed by looking into the shiny surfaces of the sword blades he had taken, so he wasn't immediately struck by his resemblance to the man before him. But something within him made it difficult to murder him outright. Felix sat for a while at the man's feet. He studied him closely. He had, by ritual, the consumption of strange mushrooms, privation, and lack of practice, lost the habit of thinking in words. So it was a shapeless, sliding thought that came to him as he looked at Vali's combed and clipped hair, the fine sword that lay at his side, the rich colour of his woolen coat. He could not have articulated what he felt, but this made the sense no less powerful. There was himself, as he could have been, had the fates weaved him a different skein. The man had said a word. Adisla. Felig instinctively recognized it for what it was, a girl's name. He did not feel unhappy, or at least he could not identify his emotion as unhappiness, but he did begin to feel uncomfortable about the path that the fates had chosen for him. He breathed in, smelling something sweet and something rancid. He saw Vali's pack and felt his saliva rise. He opened it, and without pausing to examine what he found, began to eat. He ate the honey and the stale bread and the cheese. He ate the berserker mushrooms and the long root. He couldn't abide even the smell of the wolfsbane, but the sleeping mixture was sweet and palatable, so he sucked it down and pushed his tongue into the pot to get the last drops. Then he ate the mint and drained Vali's wineskin. He began to feel peaceful, warm and relaxed. From up the valley the wolves began to howl, but he could not hear them to reply. Disa's white night potion had made the world soft. Felix lay down on the grass and slept. Chapter 15. A Captive. Vali really did think he was dreaming. He came to himself with that strange sensation that you sometimes get when waking in unfamiliar surroundings, when reality makes a sudden lurch, and you don't know where you are or how you got there. At his feet, sleeping face down, was a powerfully built man dressed in little but a wolf pelt. The ruins of the pack were next to him, all food gone, and his wineskin lay flat as a blanket at his side. At first he thought it was dark, but then he realized it was the shadow of the horses. They had pressed in as close as they could to him. No wonder. From down the valley he heard the call of a wolf. Vali grabbed for his sword and drew it, pointing it at the sleeping figure. This had to be a wolf man. Vali didn't know what to do. He knew it would be far more impressive to take the bandit alive, and, more than that, it would be proof he had a wolf man and not some dressed-up slave. But the man, no older than he was impressively muscled. Even the thralls who did most of the heavy labor on the farms were not made so powerfully. If he awoke while Vali was tying him up, then the prince didn't fancy his chances in a wrestling competition. Vali looked around him. The pack was completely empty, everything in it gone. There were the little cloth bags in which he'd carried Disa's herbs, all torn. There was the empty honey pot, and the one containing the sleeping draught. He smiled to himself when he realized what had happened. Carefully, he pushed the tip of his sword into the wolf man's back, drawing a little blood. That was a relief, knowing that ordinary weapons could hurt him. The wolf man didn't even stir. Vali took the cord from the saddle at his side. He'd never actually needed to tie anyone up before, and didn't quite know how to do it, so he erred on the side of caution, binding the man's hands behind his back, then his legs, then his hands again and his legs again. He had never thought of himself as religious or superstitious, but he was almost afraid to touch the wolf man, and certainly didn't want to move the wolf pelt he wore over his head. It was a magical item, capable of transforming the man into a snarling half-wolf. Even the merchant Veles Libor had taken those stories seriously, Varley thought of the remedies for magic that he knew. Not many. He'd had no reason or opportunity to learn them. However, he knew that magicians were supposed to be able to enchant you with their gaze, and a way to negate this power was to blindfold them. He had nothing that would do for a blindfold. He did, however, have the bag that he had taken the rope from. But as he lifted the wolfman to slide the bag over his head, he caught a glimpse of something extraordinary. The man was strikingly similar to Varley himself. His face was far more weather-beaten and lean, and his hair was wild. But his beard was sparse and thin, like Varley's, his features virtually identical. Varley shivered. This was truly a shapeshifter. He pulled the bag over the man's head, taking care not to touch the magical wolf pelt, breathed out heavily, and told himself to be calm. Was this a shapeshifter? It was possible, he thought, that the man simply resembled him. He had seen very few dark-haired men. Perhaps they all looked the same. Bragi said the people of the Far West Islands had dark hair, and you couldn't tell one from another. He also said that they stank, and this man certainly did. Varley thought on. He had heard rumours and stories brought back by traders of something called a fetch, an evil spirit that copied someone's appearance. He couldn't remember what it was meant to do, but he was sure it wasn't very pleasant. He tried to regain his calm. He told himself he had been tired. No wonder he was seeing things. The sooner he was back at Forkbeard's Hall, the better, he thought. He tacked up the horses. Varley didn't quite know the best way to transport the wolfman. So he improvised. He pulled the man up to a standing position and then shouldered him across the saddle of the horse. He tied the wolfman's hands to his feet around the animal and then looped a rope around his waist. He wound that around the pommel of the saddle at the front and the cantle at the rear. All the time the wolfman lolled and flopped as if he was dead. Varley pushed and tugged at him to make sure he was secure. When he was satisfied with his work, the prince tied the reins of his captive's horse to his own saddle, mounted, and kicked towards home. From somewhere up towards the black bulk of the mountain, he heard the wolves call. He headed down the valley with the horses at a trot. The sooner he was out of this country, he thought, the better. Chapter 16. An Engagement. News of his arrival had spread from the outer farms, and the people of Ekund were there in numbers to greet him as he arrived at Forkbeard's Hall. He had gone there by the most direct route, bypassing Disa's house. He had asked the first person he'd met about her, and had been told she was very poorly. Visiting her, he thought, would be too much for her at that moment, and he decided to wait until the clamour that greeted his arrival had died down, though he sent her word of his success. Every child in the area was running ahead of him, shouting and whooping and calling him a hero. Some of them touched the wolfman as he passed, or threw mud and cursed him. Women, too, rained insults on the man, and hit him with sticks for good measure. Varley had to tell them to stop it, as they were frightening his horses. The men stood with their arms folded, shaking their heads and laughing to themselves. They had misjudged Varley, it seemed, and they were glad to have been mistaken. Finally, he had acted in a way they understood. One or two of the farmers came forward with knives, shouting that they would kill the wolfman there and then. Varley drew his sword, and they backed off. They were glory thieves, he thought, and if they wanted to kill a wolfman, they could go and get one of their own. It had taken 2 weeks for Varley to make his way home. The return had been in some ways harder than his outward journey. Leaving Ekund, he had been in a trance and had had to make no decisions regarding his direction of travel. On his way back, he had had no such help and had to decide his way for himself. However, he did recognize the country he had travelled through, and in the lush northern summer his tracks were clear. Hoofprints from his horses, the nibbled bushes and manure that showed he had made camp. He even managed to shorten his journey by getting fishermen to row him across a few of the fjords. They refused payment when they saw his captive, glad he had rid them of a dangerous bandit. There were practical difficulties. The wolfman had woken up after a day, and Vali had been forced to chase after his horse, which had been spooked by his kicking. Vali had talked to the man, and he had become calmer, accepting his fate like an animal. The wolves had proved a disquieting presence. During the day he didn't see them, although he felt always that he was being watched, but in the long dusk he heard them in the hills. He had expected the wolfman to reply. Vali knew these sorcerers were said to command wolves. He decided that if the wolfman called for help, he would have to kill him. His prisoner remained silent, though. There was the problem of untacking the horses at night, and of replacing the wolfman in the saddle every morning, but, these difficulties aside, the journey had gone smoothly. They passed farmsteads, and Vali asked for supplies. The farmers would have been generous to any traveller, but, like the fishermen, when they saw the prince had a captured bandit, they were elated. They gave freely, and Vali ate well. At first, Vali was almost pleased to see that the wolfman had developed sores from the chafing of the saddle on his side. He allowed him to drink, sparingly, once a day, though he never fully removed the bag, but he gave him no food. This meant that if he should work free of his bonds, he would be less able to fight or run. Part of him was almost inclined to let him die. But Vali had finally begun to appreciate the merits of portraying himself as a hero. It might be a lie, but it gained him the respect of his fellows and made life easier. A week from home, Vali had begun to feed the wolfman, to give him more water, and to sit him upright on the horse. He wanted him to look fierce when he arrived back, the better to reflect on himself. Vali's success, it was agreed, was spectacular. It had been thought the mission would take him a minimum of 2 months, and that Adisla would hang. He had returned in less than one, and she was free. Adisla was not at the hall. With Forkbeard gone to the assembly at Nidani's, along with all the nobles and the rest of the court, enthusiasm for keeping her confined had waned. She had never been more than half a day's walk from her farm in her life, so was unlikely to run off, reasoned her guards. Her habit of singing in a discordant voice during the evenings hadn't endeared her to them either, and they'd let her go back to her mother. However, as Vali tied up his horses, he was led aside by Hongni and Ori, both in a fever of agitation.
"Prince Vali! Prince Vali!" said Hongni. "I must talk to you."
"You have nothing to say to me," he said. "Your animals are safe, and you may take them back now." Hongni kept his voice as low as he could.
"You are in great danger."
"Are you my vassals?"
"Yes, Lord."
"Then act like it. Fetch me mead, and be silent."
"Lord, we must speak to you."
Hongni grabbed at his arm. Vali glowered at him.
"Do you presume to touch your prince?"
"You must leave this place. You must leave now," said Hongni.
"Why?"
"It is cursed. A calamity is about to befall these people."
"What sort of calamity?"
"We have only heard whispers, Lord. Some say it will be a plague, some say the Danes are coming, but your mother wants you out of here by the next full moon."
"Tomorrow," Vali smiled. "Well, my mother can wait." "You have a choice. Stay here and share whatever fate befalls us, or go back to my father and do the dead lord's jig, should he keep his temper long enough to hang you. Personally, I think your chances of survival are vastly better here." Hongni and Ori stood tall.
"We are warriors, and not afraid to die."
"Then prove it. Stay to the full moon, and then I'll be happy to accompany you back to my father's court."
"You are dismissed."
The Horder men walked away, overcome as much by the change in Vali as by his refusal to go with them. He was no longer the daydreaming, sword-shy boy he had appeared before, but now acted in a way they would expect from the son of Orthon the White Wolf. Vali watched them go. The Rygir were beginning a celebration. A horn of mead was shoved into his hand, and he drank it down. Something was happening, he didn't know what. But his mother would never have acted on hearsay. What was most likely, a plague? There was nothing he could do about that. His mother might have seen it through a witch's vision, he supposed, but Yrsa had a well-known dislike of magic. What else? He made himself think practically. Pipes were playing inside the hall. Jokul, the skald, was already singing a song about him. The only eventuality he could do anything about was a raid. If that was going to happen, then he should stay to defend the people who had raised him. Vali looked down at the little port. It was empty, save for a few fishing boats. Forkbeard had taken his 3 drakars with him, and the knars were all away on trading missions. He had chosen a bad time for glory, he thought. He pulled the wolfman down from his horse and tied him to a birch tree near Forkbeard's hall. He called out in a loud voice, declaring the man his prisoner and warning that no one should do him any harm until Forkbeard had seen him. More mead was offered to him. He accepted. Then Adisla was there, running down the hillside, calling out his name. She was laughing, almost jumping with joy. Vali couldn't help but start laughing himself. The sort of laugh that comes from someone who bends to tie his shoe and feels a rock whiz past his head. She fell on him and hugged him, and he kissed her as she clung to him.
"I have to say," she said, "I didn't have a great deal of faith you would make it back."
"We're so alike," said Vali.
"Neither did I."
She laughed again, although when he looked down at her, he could see she was crying.
"How did you do it?"
"I don't know. I'm waiting to hear what the Skalds come up with. I'm going to say I challenged him to 3 competitions, eating, drinking, and fighting, and made him so drunk with the drinking that I tied him up. What do you think?"
"They'll say you fought him."
"Well," said Vali, "let them then. Who knows? Maybe I did. I would have fought a score of wolf men for you."
"Only a score?" said Adisla.
"There has to be a limit," said Vali, "and a score is mine. One more than that, and you'd be on your own." This joking and teasing was familiar to them, but there was more to it now, something more insistent. Vali felt that his only way forward was with this girl, the only way he could see the future. He had to tell her what had been between them since the moment they met, but neither of them had ever quite managed to say. "I love you." She looked into his eyes.
"Yes."
"You don't say you love me."
"Because the feeling is too strong. If I speak it, I would never be able to deny it."
She hardly managed to get the end of the sentence out, stammering into sobs and putting her hand to her face to disguise her tears. "Do you intend to deny it?" She said nothing and turned her face away.
"You cannot forget me, Adisla." "I'll never forget you."
She threw her arms around him and wept into his shoulder. "Will you marry him?" Adisla stepped back from him, composed herself, and looked directly into Vali's eyes. Even through her tears, she looked so pretty, thought Vali. He wanted to stop her crying, to make it all right for her, to see her smile and hear her laugh. but he knew that he was the cause of all her miseries. He was a hair's breadth from everything he had ever wanted. The girl he loved, a beautiful summer afternoon, the sun warm beneath a fresh breeze. But it may as well all have been an ocean away. "You will," he said.
"Vali, I will not be your concubine, and I cannot be your wife. What choice do I have?"
Vali nodded. "Drengi is a fine man. He's been a good friend to all of us. I wish you could have picked someone who I could have consoled myself by hating."
"I didn't pick him, Vali. How many men are there to choose from? 5 farmers' sons in the whole area, and 3 of those wouldn't look at me because I have such a skinny dowry. And I'm old, Vali. 3 summers past the time most girls are married. Fate put us together."
"No," said Vali. "Fate put us together. Our skein is woven into 1 cloth.
The wolf man was given to me. I didn't need to lift a finger. The gods were on my side." "I've never heard you mention the gods before. I've never needed them before. I swear, Lord Odin, give me this girl, or I will move against you in whatever way I can."
On a tree behind the hall, 2 ravens alighted. Adisla's eyes widened.
"Well,"
she said, stroking Vali's cheek.
"He's heard you now."
Vali felt tears come into his own eyes, though he chuckled. "Well, listen to this then, you couple of mangy chickens. Tell your master that if I don't get what I want, then I'm coming for him. He should keep his spear by his side, because if he defies me, the gods' final day starts here." He tapped his sword. The ravens took off again, moving low across the buildings, their black shapes rising up and over the hill like forgetful little pieces of the night flapping out of the day.
"Shh," said Adisla, almost ducking. "What if those are his intelligences?"
She laughed, but Vali could see that she meant what she said. He smiled. "Let's hope they are," he said, "because I want him to hear the message." Vali wasn't sure at first if the blow had caught him on his chest or his back. It was so hard that it nearly knocked him into Adisla. He turned to see Bragi, the old man's face glowing and his arms wide.
"You did it, boy. You did it. I never had a moment's doubt. How could you fail with the training you've had? You did it."
"Thank you, Bragi," said Vali. "I couldn't have done it without you."
The old man almost danced a jig.
"Let me see the old girl," he said, taking the sword from Vali's scabbard. "I bet you had a good sup of wolf blood, didn't you, my lady?"
Vali looked at Adisla. There was the destiny he wanted, home, hearth, and love, ready to walk away from him. He looked at Bragi, the destiny that had been thrust upon him, and for the first time saw it was useless to resist.
I killed 3 of them, said Vali. "It was the crafty pommel strike you drilled into me that did for 2. "Good lad, good lad. More mead, more mead," said Bragi. "This is a king, didn't I tell you? This is a king!"
Chapter 17. Strange Meeting. Vali stayed in the hall, drinking away the raw emotions that were in him. Adisla did not join the party. She had said what she had to say, and could see that her presence was causing him torment. Vali collapsed with the others who had celebrated his return, a collection of old warriors, youths, and the handful of unfavored jarls who had stayed behind when Forkbeard sailed east. He became drunker and more unhappy with every sip he took. Eventually, he couldn't remember how it happened. He was fighting someone, His opponent was worse for wear than he was, and collapsed on the floor under his blows, cold unconscious. All Vali could focus on was Bragi's face, red and roaring, holding up his arm and saying what a mighty man he had raised. The acclaim of the hall rang in his ears. He could drink no more, and crawled beneath a bench, where he slept, his body restless, but his mind dead. Adisla, however, did not sleep. She returned to her mother, and told her to accept the offer of marriage from Drengi. Disa, who had not been able to leave her bed since she was burned, hugged her daughter to her.
"You're sure? You'll leave your prince behind. This is the fate that has been woven for me. The shore may as well wish to be the sea as I to marry him."
Disa held the sobbing girl to her.
"Go on," said Adisla. "Let it be done quickly."
Disa let her go and sent Manni up to the hill farms. Adisla could not sleep that night, though it wasn't the enduring sun that kept her awake, but her thoughts. It was no use. Her bed might have been made of nettles for all the chance she had of sleeping in it. She got up and wandered down to the sea. It was as near to night as the midsummer had to offer, a pale, washed-out light like that of the pre-dawn, rather than true, deep darkness. She found herself by the hall, listening to the sounds of drunken laughter from inside. It was late, but the drinking showed no signs of stopping. Adisla couldn't bring herself to share in the fun, even though she had the most to celebrate. She felt hollow with misery, but knew she had done the right thing. Her thoughts were like trolls reaching at her from the darkness of her mind. She tried to lose herself in the beauty of the moon, low and huge against the sky of smoky silver. It was nearly full. For a month or more, her destiny had been tied to it. Now, in days, she thought, Forkbeard would be home. She thought of the story of how the god of the moon had snatched two children while they drew water at a well, and how those children now rode with him in his chariot in the sky, pursued by a dreadful wolf called Hate, who snapped at their heels. She had a wolf following her, one that had been set on her at birth. Her station, her rank. She had seen what she wanted, as if from across an impassable river. Suddenly she felt very cold. She was, she noticed, sitting in the shadow of a pale birch tree. The darkness there seemed unnaturally deep, and the air around her was very still, as if it had a weight to it, one that she would struggle to push away. And behind her, she felt a presence. Something quite unlike anything she had felt before, something that seemed born of cold waters and dark, damp spaces. "Is there someone there?" She felt ridiculous saying this. She stood and looked around. Like an arrow storm, starlings broke across the moon, wheeling in a shifting black cloud that turned and darted as one. The sudden changes in the bird's direction made Adisla think of a thousand tiny gates opening and closing in the sky, and of a story Vali had told her, one he'd got from Arab merchants, of a jinn, a demon of smoke, towering over her. As quickly as they had come, the birds were gone, and with them the cold and oppressive feeling in the air. It was then she thought of the wolfman. She looked up past the last of the houses to the single birch where he was tied. She was curious to see this strange bandit who had been forced to trade his life for hers, so she made her way up the hill. When she got to the birch, Tassi, the fat old man who had been charged with guarding him, was sitting on a low, three-legged stool and looking very unhappy. Next to him was the wolfman, seated on the ground, leaning against the tree with his hands tied to it behind his back. He still had the bag on his head. The people of Ekund shared Vali's superstition about sorcerers and were not about to allow him to enchant them.
"Hello, Tassi,"
said Adisla.
"You're not about to start singing, are you? He might be a wolfman, but he doesn't deserve that. We draw the line at hanging him round here."
"No,"
said Adisla. She looked at the wolfman. He was naked, apart from a wolf pelt around his back, and his body was smeared in a grey substance that she took to be chalk dust. The only places free of the grey were two red sores on his stomach and chest. His muscles were remarkable, even to a farm girl who lived among people strong through toil. Even the berserks, with their potions and their constant drilling with weapons, their wrestling and their tests of strength, were not made like that. The man's muscles seemed almost twisted onto his bones, like willow roots around stone. She was almost inclined to check he was securely tied. She wondered that a normal rope could hold him.
"Quite a specimen, isn't he?" said Tessie. "Although I got tired of looking at him after about 10 breaths, and now I wouldn't mind just getting slaughtered."
Adisla didn't reply. She was scared of the wolfman, but intrigued by him. Was it true what people said, that he had the head of a wolf, or that only the best steel could cut him? The man didn't look dangerous now. He was clearly exhausted and breathing heavily.
"I said," said Tassie, "that I wouldn't mind the chance to take a cup of ale."
"So?"
"Well, if you're going to be here for a while, couldn't you watch him, and if he tries to get away, just come and get me?"
"Couldn't you have paired one of the children to do that?"
Then she remembered. Tassie was notoriously mean. He didn't pay for anything if he could help it. He shrugged, as if she had made a ludicrous suggestion.
"Go and have a drink," she said, "but don't be too long. I want to go home to bed soon."
"Make sure you don't take him with you,"
said Tassie, smiling and getting up.
"What?"
"I see the way you look at him," he said. "He's out of bounds, but should you be in the mood..."
"Go and have your drink," said Adisla.
"As you like," said Tassie.
He slouched off towards the hall. Adisla didn't like to admit it, but Tassie had been right to a point. She did find the wolfman fascinating. But she couldn't find a man like that attractive. He stank, for a start, a musty smell more animal than human. She sat down on the stool. She wanted to say something sympathetic, something to make him feel better, but couldn't think of anything. Instead, she heard herself ask,
"Are you sorry for your crimes now?"
The wolfman said nothing. A shadow flitted across her, and Adisla looked up to see what it was. There was nothing there, though the speed of its passing made her think of the starlings. She was possessed by a sudden urge to see what he looked like. She thought that if he tried to enchant her, then she would just look away. There was no one about, and the riotous sounds from the hall were as loud as ever. She leaned forward and touched his arm. It was just as it looked, hard as a tree. Some of the grey came off on her fingers. She licked at it. As she had thought, it was some sort of chalk. The wolfman had not flinched when she touched him, and this made her bolder. She lifted up the hood on his head. Now he did move, his head lolling forward. At first, she thought he really did have an animal's head. Then she realized it was the pelt of a large wolf, which had slipped down to cover his face. He coughed and stretched his neck. Gingerly, she lifted the pelt and was so surprised she sat back down on the stool.
Varley was looking straight at her.
"You are a sorcerer!"
The implications of what she saw began to sink in. If this was a shapeshifter, if he could appear exactly as Varley, then, if he got free, he could take the prince's place, eat with them, play, and who knows what more. Perhaps they would have climbed the hills and lain kissing on the grass together. Perhaps they would have gone out in the little boat, as she and Vali often did. And then what? Murder.